This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. In the next 60 minutes, we're going to talk about fascism. Professor of History Victoria de Grazia has written a captivating book on the subject. The Perfect Fascist, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. Now stand by for an intriguing conversation. First, one of our most downloaded podcasts from the last year was my conversation with Jason Stanley on his book, How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. Not least of all because the words fascist and fascism keep appearing in the news. In his excellent book, Jason Stanley lists 10 pillars of fascist politics, and one of them is law and order, words we probably hear far too much lately. Here then is an excerpt from my talk with Jason Stanley. One area I focused on is your reporting of what happened in Baltimore to Freddie Gray. You go into detail in how CNN used the word protest and MSNBC used the word protest, and then they used riot, while over at Fox, they mainly used riot. Can you talk about the difference in the words used, Jason?
So there's a long history in the United States of representing black political protests as riots. Now, of course, what you do in doing that is suppose you have a large protest and a couple people act badly, act violently, then you just focus on them and you call it a riot. And you ignore the fact that the whole thing was a protest. Catherine Bigelow's movie Detroit shows this. I mean, you know, all Americans are raised with the idea that there were these riots in Detroit. And I was raised without knowing why there were people on the street in Detroit and why there were military, the whole city was militarized. Well, it was because it was a protest against police brutality. We just got a rerun of that in Baltimore. So the issue is whether you describe things as a protest or a riot. James Baldwin in his piece, Negroes are anti-Semitic because they're anti-white, he says, the boys and girls in Watts and Harlem realized that in the Warsaw Ghetto, they were represented as heroes, whilst they were represented, as rioters. So in Baltimore, Fox News used the word riot to describe what was happening in Baltimore. I think 7 words out of 1,000 and protest 2 words out of 1,000. CNN used riot at around the same level as protest, like 3.5 words per 1,000. And MSNBC used protest more than riot to describe what was happening in Baltimore. And so you see a very strong effect of describing the same events. If you describe them as riots, you create one political picture.
Yes.
If you describe them as protests, you create quite another political picture.
This is such an interesting area because this then ties back to your previous book, How Propaganda Works, which I read after How Fascism Works, I should tell you. They're companion pieces. Now let's move to another.
And I should note, I have a forthcoming book with Princeton with the linguist David Beaver called Hustle, The Politics of Language, which is a huge academic track on rhetoric.
Oh, good.
On all of this.
Oh, God, we're really into that. Oh, great. We have to talk to you about that, get you back on. Now let's go to an area that I think is just fascinating because of all the connotation. Sodom and Gomorrah, and you say, in fascist ideology, the rural life is guided by an ethos of self-sufficiency which breeds strength. In rural communities, one does not need to depend on the state, unlike the parasites in the city. Let's talk about that.
So, again, in Nazi ideology, Jews were lazy. They lived off interest that they got from loaning money. The hardworking Germans earned the money, and Jews were just lazy and lived off the state because the state protected their lending practices. So the idea was you should force Jews to work for free. That's why the gates of Auschwitz said, Arbeit macht frei, work shall make you free, one reason. So there's this idea that people in the rural areas, they're hardworking, they're they work to earn their money, and then people in the cities, they're just lounging around collecting. You know, Hitler in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf complains about all the state funding going to the arts to support sort of lazy, decadent artists in the city. And the idea, and time after time, you find that the out-group, whatever that out-group is across the world, are supposed to be lazy. They're supposed to be lazy, decadent, and criminal. So it was very surprising to me. It was surprising to me to see these education textbooks from the 1930s in Germany showing soft Jewish hands. That has not worked, you know, and of course in the United States. So, and sort of across the world, we find out-group in many, many fascist movements, the out-group lives in the city. So this is, you know, this is a revelation to me, because the expression inner city in American English is code word for place where black people live. Well, the cities were the place where the Jews were supposed to live in Nazi ideology, in Romanian fascist ideology as well. So Hitler in chapter 2 of Mein Kampf says in Vienna, Jews, Jews, and more Jews, he says of the capital city of Austria, Vienna. So this idea that the cities are places where people sort of lounge about engaging in homosexuality and decadence and living off the state, and in the rural areas, people are working hard and honest workers. That's a leitmotif of fascist politics.
Jason Stanley's book is How Fascism Works, The Politics of Us and Them. You can hear my full interview over at Mixcloud. Just look for Life Elsewhere. This music is to set the mood for my next conversation with Professor Victoria De Grazia on her wonderful book, The Perfect Fascist, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. The book is called The Perfect Fascists, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. Now imagine this, it's June of 1926, it's Rome, and there's a very grand wedding going on. And the best man at the wedding is Mussolini. And I'm going to ask my guest, the author of this fabulous book, Victoria De Grazia, to explain about this wedding and then get into talking more about this wonderful, wonderful book. Victoria, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
There's a wedding taking place in Rome. It's June, it's 1926. Mussolini is the best man. How did Mussolini come to be the best man at this wedding?
That's the question that got me going. Wonderful Jewish bourgeois educated New Yorker came to me with bags, Bloomingdale bags of photographs and memorabilia. And she said, why is it that distant cousin Liliana, Mary, Jewish girl, very smart, talented singer, why did she marry an old bearded fascist? So I began to look into the bags. The first thing I saw was a photo album of young, very sturdy Jewish young woman, very well dressed, and a man with this beard, a little bit timid looking, in a black shirt, and Mussolini behind him, and the American ambassador, Tullio Serafin, the director of the Metropolitan Opera at the time, formerly of the La Scala, also as a witness. And the question was, for me, not why did this aspiring prima donna marry the fascist, but why did the fascist marry this extraordinary young woman in 1926? And so that was the beginning then of thinking, why, how did this event, which the New York Times at that time, in its June wedding section, called a fascist wedding, what was this about, a fascist wedding? The background, it becomes extraordinary, because that's the moment, this fascist wedding, blessed by Mussolini himself, who was the duce of this man, who turned out to have been a big fascist, a big leader of squads, but who was also his boss insofar as this man was part of his cabinet as what was in effect the undersecretary of Homeland Security. Security, let's call it that. It's actually more powerful than any other ministry in Italian life. It's a ministry of police and prefects and so on and so forth. So setting out, he said to say, this is a period of normalization. He wants all the rowdy fascists to go back home to settle and settle down. A Jewish woman. Well, Mussolini's own mentor, patron was Jewish, Margherita Sarfatti, a very prominent intellectual. And this woman had some of her gravitas. So that seems to work out. And then it was a moment that Mussolini's trying to show to the good bourgeoisie that he's a man of order, not a man of disorder. It had been 4 years since the fascists had marched on Rome. It had been barely 2 years since the terrible killing of Matteotti, the chief of the opposition, had occurred, almost toppling Mussolini. And now Mussolini was on the move for this idea of all in the state, nothing outside the state, nothing against the state. And so this marriage becomes, in some ways, a moment where we could see into the making of this new totalitarian state. And so the story goes. That's the start.
So let me just make sure everybody understands. We're talking about Attilio Turuzzi, who was a military man for, 20 years and then became a fascist. And then we just talked about his wedding.
But he was a mystery figure. There was nothing written about him. And yet I saw him, his rise and then his fall. Had been a soldier, fine, okay. Then he had been a big squadrista after he came home. Again, another story there. And then he began to rise in the ranks. Why? He didn't seem to have any particular qualities. I mean, we have to dig to find those. And then he becomes, in the end, the minister of Italian Africa, which is the biggest position in the empire.
Right.
So very little written about him, but by goodness, when I began to look at pictures, which historians can now look at because many are digitalized, or you can dig through the archives, you go to the military headquarters in Rome, you start digging and digging and digging, looking. Pretty soon I found that this man had been photographed a huge amount.
Yes.
He was like a B-actor or a Zelig, he keeps coming, appearing over time, almost always in uniform, or if he's in his bourgeois civilian dress, looking like he's in uniform. He's a very dapper dresser. He's a Milanese.
Yes.
With a beard that they sometimes call biondo, but in Italian that means red or dark or simply attractive. Blonde.
Yes.
So it turned out that this man clearly had a kind of charisma, physical charisma. Stands very straight. In Italy, men don't necessarily have military posture. So his physicality becomes, again, it's like a Zelig. You could follow him all the way through. And he was being photographed by some of the first paparazzi. The
word paparazzi
didn't exist yet until, I think it's a 60s word, Italian photographer. But he's catching the camera eye. And that is becoming, in some sense, part of the story of the man, one of those personalities who's good to look at to define moments. And especially that's important under fascism, which is so, spectacular and showy. You needed to be a kind of chameleon since the program was so many things. This is, pre-reality television. This is a man who makes his way from being photographed as a military man to being photographed as a fascist to the very end when he's being photographed on trial on the dock.
Yes. I'm talking to Victoria De Grazia. The book is called The Perfect Fascist, The Story of Love, Power, and Morality in Mussolini's Italy. A couple of points about the man, Attilio Turuzzi, is he wasn't as tall as he looks like in the photographs. He looks a very imposing man, but he wasn't that tall. Am I right about that?
Yeah, a lot of people weren't very tall and looked very imposing. I mean, Mussolini himself is not particularly tall.
Right.
Put him on a horse, put him in a uniform, and he looks darn good. And
yes.
It's a very interesting phenomenon. These are in the military records, it said he was 5'3", but that's not right. The transposition error, he's probably about 5'6". But, you know, everybody spoke of it, very handsome, even though today you'd say, you know, physique, du role of the army man, the enforcer, who'd always have your back, you know, would always be present. Very important that his particular physicality. Mussolini's, he was a great actor, transitioned from stage to cinema, and was always playing to the crowds and to people too, individual people as well. So it was a time where these fascists are really picking up on the transition from stage and opera to radio to cinema, and that's a very much part of their capacity to communicate to masses.
You give us great descriptions about Attilio's early life, about his family, about growing up. He becomes a quartermaster in the military. Oh, one other thing that you mentioned, which I loved, is that you say that his beard, he grew the beard to cover up a double chin, which I think is really fascinating. You give us lots of details about all kinds of things in the book, The Perfect Fascist. I want to go off on a slight tangent here and ask you about the writing of the book and about collating all the information, because my goodness, Victoria, you have so much detail in this book and it is absolutely fascinating. Talk to me about putting the book together, about collating all the information.
So when I first figured out the story, I said to myself, wow, this is an opera. Three acts. And then I said, oh no, Verdi, five acts.
Five acts, yes. You
know, rise, reach, grasp, overreach, fall. You know, a kind of tragedy.
Yeah.
Of a man sort of beset by fate, hubris, her hubris as well. Anybody in touch with him was sort of overreaching and so on. And that's made it seem very, very easy. And then the problem is, well, how do you tell it? I'm not a novelist. I said, this is, Henry James should be working on this. Or, you know, Manzoni. You know, this should be a great kind of operatic epic. It just should be an epic. Like the little man who rises, a man without qualities, a musel. You know, and Buddenbrooks, I kept thinking of these novels, you know, you rise and because it's a little guy. The problem is, I'm a social historian. And, you know, the details, they can't be invented. And many of the details were so amazing that they, you know, seemed super real. You know, they had to be invented. So I'm meticulous. I dig and I dig and I dig. And that's probably my strength as a historian. I want to get into the archives and dig and dig and dig and dig. So, you know, start out with the police archives and the government archives. And oddly, there's not a lot on him. And I think that because he himself was an insider, that he had things destroyed as he moved along. You know, sort of pockets were. Then I did interviews of anybody I could find who knew him or knew of him. That was very important. That way I found his granddaughter, who didn't know him but helped me with some information. How does it work? You say, all I can say is I dig and dig and dig. I know Italy well. You know, I would go to he had an important general in the war. And why did I know that this was an important general? Well, gold medal. Gold medal means a lot in Italy. And also that he was part of the victory in the end of this war. The war had terrible reversals. And this general, of which he was the aide-de-camp, was important. So I went to the archive in Vicenza, the military archive where he came from, and the papers where it shows some correspondence with Cinuzzi. So it was really digging, digging, digging. And often I said, is it worth it, this guy and this person? My feminist friend said, oh God, why can you spend time on such a creep or on a guy? whatever. Why are you spending so much time? I said, this is an important story. This is an important story. His women, important, and how do they appear? Because often they complained and they wrote to Mussolini. And Mussolini's private papers are, those of governmental kind, are available, his private secretariat. And I sort of combed through, and they would then be put in the file on Taruzzi, these letters from his women complaining that he'd done this or that. And they would confide in Mussolini. They'd say, Mussolini, you're our president and you're a good man. So that was one way. So it's a lot of serendipity. In fact,
yes.
To sort of round out your answer, I've never done a book based on discovery. Wow, serendipity, a chance. I was willing to go and go and go because the problem of this man's power and how a rather primitive guy, skilled but not super intelligent, got so far. Why
right.
He would be attracted to this powerful woman. Why, in fact, he was attracted to some very good women.
Well, you've just now led me to, there's so many questions that you've led me to, and I'm going to try and get to them. Let me just remind my listeners, I'm talking to Victoria de Grazia. The book is called The Perfect Fascist. It is a fabulous read. One thing that I need to point out to my listeners, the way you're telling, way you're talking to me right now, is a lot like reading your book. You have a great passion in your writing, and there's some humor that comes through in your book, which I find, just because it is very serious, yet at the same time you don't sort of shy away from giving just a little tweak here and there of letting us know how you're feeling about things. I love that, Victoria. One thing that in your book, and you talked about his women and about who he was, and I say his women just for sake of, you understand, I don't think you say, I don't remember you saying in the book that he was a philanderer, but he certainly was. I think you talk about a lot of his different behavior, but he certainly was a philanderer.
Utterly. I mean, it's part of the culture.
Yeah.
But he seemed to go, he was known for that. And then that was a big question. Why is he particularly being cited as being overboard, so sexualized? And, I think, well, okay, part of it is that he separates from his wife and therefore he doesn't have a legal spouse. And under fascism, that meant that you were pretty uncovered.
Yes.
Who are you? What are you doing? In Italy, Mussolini wanted everybody to be married. Then what they did, once they were married, well, Mussolini himself spoke of having a harem, as they call it.
Yes, yeah.
Several women, his legal wife, and then he had numbers of other children. Tiruzzi didn't have that privilege because he was separated and he couldn't get a divorce from her because she refused.
Yes.
And Italy didn't have divorce, and so he was always engaged in this terrible annulment process with the Catholic Church fighting with the priest, trying to get this annulment and trying to force the Pope, pressure of the judges and so on and so forth, which is part of the big story. I won't tell you.
No, because you write.
But philanderer, he was more than that. There's a lot of questions. Being a man alone, like a woman alone, in the fascist regime was the object of a lot of rumor. That's how fascism worked. You couldn't do anything, but you could sort of speculate, what does he go with? Does he go with guys? Does he go with little girls? Does he go with this? And there's a lot of denunciation. So, I suggest that he's certainly going with very young women.
Yes.
Whether they're the girls from the summer camp, as some police informers allege, I have to raise some questions. It's like the Jack the Ripper story. Was it the crown prince?
Yes.
Who was raping and gutting women? Because again, the fascists created, when you wanted to criticize the fascist regime, you spoke not the truth, but a lot of gossip. Is it the truth? There's a lot of melodrama going on. And this man is, to use a word that comes to me, it's probably the easier word, cathexic. It sticks on to him. So he's considered a lecher. He's considered this or that. He's also a colonial soldier. He's also involved with the colonies, and that creates a lot of sexual innuendo. But these fascist leaders tended to have this aura around them of uncertainty about whether they're making depredations of the women, and especially toward the end of the regime. That's true of Mussolini too, though.
Yes.
He played to be the father of the country, to be everybody's husband, to be everybody's advisor. There's a, it's very interesting.
Yes.
Sexual,
yes.
horror around these fascist leaders. And Hitler, I mean, who seems so creepy, he had it too.
He had it too, yes. Which now leads to talking about fascism, and I want to get into that. Once again, I want to remind my listeners, in case you've just joined us, my guest is Victoria de Grazia. The book is called The Perfect Fascist, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. So fascism, but you gave me a new light on fascism. And just in some of the things that you just talked about just now, the sort of the grandiosity, the parading around, yes, we knew all about that, but there's a sort of another side to it. And that leads into the question of how Attilio Taruzzi became a fascist. He was a military man. And I'm wondering, my big question here, Victoria, is he wasn't a fascist in the Nazi sense. He was specifically a fascist in the Italian sense. And there is a distinction, I think. And I'm just wondering whether you, and this is what I'm picking up from your book, whether you think that Italy was ripe at the time, and still maybe is, for fascism in, and I guess I'm going to call it what I think it is, the fascism of Italy.
Of course, I've thought about this forever, and one's mind changes with the times. Yeah. So when I first started studying fascism, I did think of it as the, you know, sort of sui generis, Italy. I was focused on Italy. And I just took it as faith, what we thought as Marxists, that it's all a part of this big capitalism rotting at the head, which then turns to big strong men to prop itself up again. That's how I started. And that was, yes, a very standard left-wing Marxist materialist orthodox interpretation in the 1960s and 1970s. I've moved quite a bit away from that. But it isn't at all to think of Mussolini and Italian fascism as being kind of minor compared to Nazism. It's rather worse. I really am hard to see that Mussolini is the first, the genial, brilliant politician coming out of the socialist movement, capturing that nationalism is the moment, capturing that it's a Darwinist world of all against all, and that he is going to break these old Liberal Party, which no longer has a following, is desperate to try to pull itself up. The left, which can't deal with nationalism and the returning veterans, because it was against the war for good reasons, and the Catholics, who are also against the war for good reasons, and who are playing to a kind of centrism and tied to the church. So in comes Mussolini, he says, I'm reactionary and revolutionary. Take it, okay? My agenda is opportunism. I want conservatives, I want communists, I want anarcho-syndicalists, I want, you know, Catholic zealots. Come and join me to make the new, to break out, to bring Italy back to its great power status, which it had in the past. But this isn't looking back to some other time. They really believe it.
They really, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is a kind of, hey, look around. Look at all these Romans. You know, look at the bus. Look at the churches. Look at, you know, what Italy looks like.
Yes.
And it can be both modern and Roman. Roman is modern. You know, and they're coming from Milan, these men. They're not coming from Rome or from, you know, Naples and, you know, filled with enthusiasms of all sorts. These are the, you know, best and the brightest of a certain kind of political elite, which is forming after the war, which is pulling in people from all, you know, neo-nationalists, very smart people, you know, very crazy people too. It's quite a wide range. So
yes,
Mussolini then is the pioneer. By 1925, there's a lot of respect for him in conservative circles, let's say in Wall Street in the United States. They're investing in him. By 1929, he's saying he's got labor under control, that it's not fair that plutocratic Britain should control all of this empire. It's old, it's troglodyte, it's a class-based system. Make way for the new proletarian nations, Italy. And the revisionist ones, maybe Germany too, Argentina, Brazil, you know, make way for you. By 1934, after Hitler's coming to power, he's the senior man, Mussolini, only last 2 years because then Hitler began, and they've dealt with the depression with their new labor organizations, with their militarism, which begins to get these economies geared up. They seem to be the new way. So by the end of 1940, I'm chagrined, I'm distressed, but we have to speak that fascism presents itself as the third way between what they call plutocratic capitalism, which is also, they said, racist in the United States, and Judeo-Bolshevism in the Soviet Union. Yeah. And if you look at the people who are following it in Europe, my goodness, Mitterrand, 1940, he believes that you should think corporate, labor, capitalist institutions. The most famous socialist leader of Europe of that time, an intellectual, Heinrich Dahman, he had become a kind of neo-socialist, what they call that. So National Socialism, as an idea, was very well established. Mussolini had conquered a big empire in Italy. Nazi Germany was on the march. And they were in this Nazi fascist new order, which I talk about its background in my book.
Yes.
Which has Taruzzi now, this old colonialism, going to Germany and prancing around, you know, hailing the Wehrmacht soldiers as they come back from the conquest of France, sharing his empire plans with Heydrich and the national security state, sharing the plans for empire so that the Germans are helping to shape their plans for invading Eastern Europe, which we now know are based on what they saw the Italians doing with all their settlers and new villagers and very elegant kind of plans.
Yes.
So, you know, I'm taking very seriously that Mussolini is the pioneer, this Italian state, second-rate power, overreaching clearly, but joining with Germany, that's the Axis, and then joining with Japan. These people have a big project, which is global, and we can't underestimate it now. My younger colleagues have been working on this, and they're finding really very disturbing how much collaboration there was until 1940. And yes. Then when the war breaks out and it's seen that they're now moving eastward but also westward, that's the challenge then to the Soviet Union and then to the United States, which will lead them eventually to become allies. That's the very big picture, you know, the background in which Taruzzi's march takes place, you know, the start.
Yes.
And you know, coming home from the war, saying Italy's struggles have been in vain, Italy's a powerful country, and then, you know, that's the beginning, and then the end is, you know, the end is going to be 1945. But.
Earlier on, you were talking about Taruzzi, and you were saying that some of your friends asked you, why would you be spending so much time writing about this little creep? After writing the book, or maybe as you're writing the book, did you change your mind about Attilio? Did you find... there's something about the way you're writing about him that were you not enamored so much as did you get to the point where you kind of liked him? You didn't despise him?
Yeah. I mean, the fact is, a person is a person, and
yeah.
That it calls for a kind of empathy. This is a little guy. He's the one that goes so far when he should have quit. He should have gone to Switzerland with his companion, a Jewish woman, and their daughter, and gotten out of Italy and said they're going to have to hide because she's Jewish. He is the man who's sentenced to the longest term in jail, okay, in penitentiary. Why? You know, he writes incredibly long reports that nobody reads, or if they try to read them, they're so detailed that you can only assume that he's for whatever the current policy is.
Yes.
In a way.
Yes.
So he's not a sympathetic person ever, but clearly his mother adores him. Several good women adore him and are deluded by him. He's a very hard worker, and he's a rat. I didn't love him at all. More, all the more for him being a rat. My goodness knows, the notion of love, but there's a kind of sympathy for the human plight.
Right. Yes.
Also, to show that this fascism was despicable, horrible, but heartfelt. And if we don't understand that, if we dismiss all of this as deplorable or immoral, or Italians are always doing that, they're melodramatic, they're fascist, then, or I've heard some people say there could never be fascists, those Italians, because they're so kind and so on. You don't get into how these movements grow, become so entrenched, and become so involving that it's very difficult to see what the alternative is.
Did you get the feeling, as you're, the more information you're getting about Taruzzi, if he'd have taken just if one door had opened another way, he wouldn't have become a black shirt, he wouldn't have aligned himself with Mussolini? What, was it just fate? What, or was it deliberate on his part?
Well, he comes back from the war, and he's a major, and my sort of surmise would have been that if a liberal conservative government had managed to reestablish itself as it did in Great Britain and did in France, and in some ways did in Germany too, at least down to 33, that he would have found his space, used his colonial ties, and become, you know, a merchant, philandering on the side, you know, part, or he would have actually become, maybe been brought into industry to discipline workers.
Yes.
You know, that's the kind of person he was. That's what would have happened if there had been no Great War. He would have retired and been given a sinecure, let's say in the railroad system or in some state bureaucracy, because he had done his military service. And he would have probably risen slowly to become the head of his service, you know, the head of his, and that's what, you know, so he would have become the head of some sort of rather authoritarian bureaucracy in Italy.
Yes.
And fascinating. In other words, I don't believe that fascists are born, fascists are made, you know, by opportunity sets. You know, it's not something you couldn't try to imagine. I mean, historians are not supposed to think, oh, what would, if there had been another history, what would Hitler have become? You know, somebody said, well, you know, he would have been, stayed a house painter. I mean, there's sort of silly ways of, you know, what would Joseph Stalin have become? There, you know, I mean, it might be fun to dinner conversations, that sort of thing, especially if people know well the societies, what would they have become? And it helps one to think maybe about who they are, what kinds of people they are. I don't believe, frankly, in some notion of a fascist character or a Nazi character. Clearly, though, if you're in power and you've got the power, then you become that character.
Yes.
But it's very, authoritarian systems draw on many different personality types in different periods of time. So that Mussolini, the former revolutionary, should have become the leader of the black, of the fascist movement. In Italy, kind of it makes sense. The left was very, very strong. That would have been impossible in Germany for an ex-socialist leader. You know, just the nature of the Socialist Party in Germany, very, none went over, want to be caught out here. You know, it wasn't, you know, they were going to go back and, you know, back and forth.
Yes.
Kind of what we call counterfactuals, and it's hard to go there. But the way Taruzzi, I don't go ended, you know, you sort of imagine him, you know, just wanting to settle down at the end with his wife. But that was because the fascist period was over.
Yeah.
Once it was over, you know, they all just wanted to settle down and become...
Victoria, let's go back in time a little bit. So when he was a young soldier, North Africa was very good for Attilio. That's where he rose up the ranks from a quartermaster. It seems to me that he enjoyed his time in being a colonialist in North Africa. Can you just talk about that?
Yes, well, think of, you know, for those of you who don't know Italy, think of the Foreign Legion, you know, yeah. How that was so important for young men in the late 19th century. There was nothing going on in these countries. They were so bourgeois, yeah. Anti-bourgeois in France. Or think of the colonies for British, you know, to yes. get out yeah. into the world, get away from our families, and especially if you didn't have income or much future because of you had your older brother. In his case, he was from, you know, a class where he would have ended up being an accountant, God forbid, if he could have stood it, and probably a radical accountant too, which is almost an oxymoron. And so he joins the colonial army. And you know, that was a liberating experience. The only problem for the Italians, at least down until 1911 or so, was there were not enough colonial wars that they were winning. And there's a sort of a period where they just sat there in the, you know, in Eritrea, a little place in Italian Somalia, they were kind of junior partners of the British. And then in 1911, whoa, big chance, the Ottoman Empire is falling apart, and Italy grabs Libya, says, this is ours. We've always been there. Look at Cyrene. Look at Tripoli. Look at all those columns. Look at all those amphitheaters that the Romans built. They look like they were built yesterday. So that's the first big war where he's wounded. He gets silver medal. And soldiers who were there, and especially if they were allowed to go move from the front in World War I, which is on the high mountains, the worst front probably in World War I, was on the northern fronts between Austria and Italy. And he gets moved back to head up a battalion of, battalion major in this place called Derna. Oh my God, it's paradise. You know, 5,000 people, they're Arabs and Jews, a few Italians, beautiful women, especially the Jewish ones, because they were not veiled, so you could see them, and beautiful sea breezes. And he would have, you know, if he could have, he probably would have stayed there. That's what we understand. And instead, demobilized, they have to go back to Italy. And to what? You know, they're going to get some bonus, some pension. Nobody respects them because there were so many people against the war, especially in Milan. There's chaos. You know, the king's army is sworn to uphold order. And what do they see? People rioting, striking, disrespect for the flag, and so on. So that mentality of the army man who is disappointed at his fate and then sees, you know, the love of country and the king and Italy desecrated, well, you know, that makes him very sour. And then he also doesn't have an appointment. So that a Mussolini would say, hey, Major, when he meets him, you know, when you come back home, when you're demobilized, join us, we're going to need men like you, and recognizes his rank, you know, can read the stripes and the stars and say, he's a major. Taruzzi, on the other hand, looks at Mussolini and says, wow, this man is in civvies, and he makes me feel, you know, like a buck private. He's so powerful with his glowing eyes and his rough beard and his simple dress, because Mussolini always dressed in a sort of poor anarchist way in black suits and sort of grubby cuffs, always working at the press. It was kind of natural. He said, ooh, this man, he's not in uniform, but he looks like a leader to me. And that was an interesting way, you know, not that he's smitten, but he says, this man is a leader and he needs me. He needs me to organize the squads, discipline the squads so they don't, you know, act off and act like rabble, you know. So I have a new leader.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Victoria De Grazia. The book is called The Perfect Fascist, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. Something we really have to focus in on, and that are the women in his life, or the main women in his life, because apparently there were lots of women. But of course, we've got to talk about Liliana, and we also have to talk about Yvette Black. So let's start with Liliana.
Without Liliana, we would know nothing about Taruzzi.
Yeah.
And when she thought that she made him in a way, she thought they were going to be a power couple, you know, this young American. So it's the idea of youthful America marrying old Europe so that they can both, you know, be powerful. She, immense talent, coming talent on the stage. he, the man in the piazza. Fasci in the lictor is a symbol of Italian rebirth in the fascist movement, with the American flag, which had just become so popular as a result of America's entry into World War I. The idea that was very common at the time of American money going together with European talent and craft and culture. Yeah. So this is like the marriage that's being made under the blessing of Mussolini. Very important, this figure. It's her letters. She wrote home. She had a powerful sense of herself as an individual. She carried her hurt very deep. And she had a very American notion of her rights. And she was also very litigious, very American sense of law, the importance of law. And she found a lot of people in Italy, important people, to support her, her notion of law. As a way, and you'll have to ask yourself, is she an anti-fascist or is she a fascist? Why does she resist the dissolution of this marriage? Other people would say, bye-bye. And some Italians said, why doesn't she just go home, leave it, forget it, go back to her career, start over? Big question that goes through the book. But she's going to be there still in 1947.
Yes.
Now, the question is, he can't marry her. I mean, he can't get rid of her. And so he finds another woman. And turns out she's Jewish. Now, she's not coming from the U.S. She's coming from Cairo, where there's a very large community. But there are a lot of similarities. And frankly, they all have physical – these are big women, taller than he is. Okay, his mother is likewise big, Lombard, country woman, bugging blue eyes, double chin. That's where he gets his. And really severe. So, you know, the man clearly – and this I could – only extrapolate, you know, but it's there. I don't.
The mother complex, yeah.
It's there. Listen, Italians are like Jews. You know, Italian mothers are like Jewish mothers. They all think their child is, you know, Jesus Christ. You know,
yes, kind of. Yes. Yeah.
So that's strong. But this woman doesn't have at all the protections that. First of all, she can't be married to him, and then she right away has a baby by him. And her citizenship is very murky, and that becomes a real problem in late 1930s Europe. You really needed citizenship, and especially if you were Jewish. And so there's a big story therein. You know, first of all, one could say, this guy has a problem with Jews, you know, that kind of question, that sort of prurient psychological, psychoanalytic question. It didn't, you know, in the end, my readers can pose it maybe differently.
Yes.
So the question is, you know, why? Why does he do this? Why can't he find somebody simpler? And there is that option, and that's interesting. Why doesn't he just have a second cousin who adores him? Why doesn't he just end up with a second cousin and so on? But again, this is part of, man, he's on the make. He's grasping, he's striving, he's overreaching, and women, his women, women generally, are totally part of the story. Everywhere I look in Italy, I see women. You know, other historians continue to write about men. I don't see it. I see a man, I see his mother, his sister, and so on. And that goes for everybody. I don't see them as single figures.
Right.
They don't exist. There's no such thing as the individual in that old bourgeois liberal sense. People are part of societies, you know, family, yes, networks. They don't exist as one. What I saw in Italy, which is more interesting because it's the 20s, is that the women are very present, organizing salons, legitimating men, supporting them, having children. And in the 1930s, they get pushed out. It turns into much more masculine, mass party, militaristic, and the women get more and more backgrounded. So when Hitler comes to power, it's pretty clear that you're not going to find women in the inner sanctum. But perhaps, again, burrowing in, if you took a figure, you could see, you know, the women. And look, it's not perchance when there are these suicides at the end, they're family suicides, you know.
Yes.
The whole Goebbels family goes together.
Right. You know. It's a sad ending.
So why, at what point does a man's loyalty to his family and to his nation lead him to split with his loyalty to the leader? Or, as other fascists put it, I'm choosing the nation and I have to get rid of Mussolini. There was that kind of thing. Others were saying, now the time has come. Splitting with Mussolini, I'm going back to my family as my first strength and loyalty. He did give me strength. He's not doing it anymore. So there is a kind of consideration of that. Truzzi's not a man with words or with diary. So it's a big question. You know, that point becomes like the unfolding where your hubris leads to a kind of tragedy, or which is the tragedy of the Italian nation, the Italian people, and the people that the Italians have conquered. That's the, if you want, the tragedy of Europe. And that was an important point of reflection. And then the question, how he took his punishment. What did he become once he was constrained in the penitentiary? He changed. And that was touching. He becomes the librarian. You know, he's a good accountant. He becomes the quartermaster again. Some traits of his, and that he was a very good prisoner, that his best friends were not the old honchos, they were the military men. In some ways, his character is revealed rather simple after this parabola where he was part of this fascist. He's both emblematic and he's the key figure in this work. But I think at the end, this is like a women's introduction to fascism, that you really should be able to come away with a strong sense of a strong interpretation of what fascism was in its time. Appreciates how horrible it was and also how heartfelt it was experienced and how terribly unevenly it was experienced, because this power is always cutting and dicing, including and excluding, saying it's for love and then deeply murderous. And that if you want, is the sort of the sense of the human tragedy that I've wanted to convey.
And you've done it so well, Victoria. Last question for you, and I'm almost hesitant in asking you this. Here we are in the United States and other parts of the world where we have strange things going on. And I don't want to start talking about specific people so much as there is some odd things going on, which some people are saying, some very serious writers are saying, that we are heading in the direction of another turn towards nationalism / fascism. I would just like to get your take on that, just very briefly.
Yeah, I finally wrote a piece to try to clarify this to myself. So I think we use the word fascist in all sorts of ways. And, you know, this is fascist, that is fascist, this is fascist. I think to call that label is not helpful. I believe that it is helpful to know what fascism was in its historical time. That is the one I'm dealing with, 1920 to 1945, an epoch in which Nazi fascism represented this third way in a world of terrible crisis, the collapse of Europe as the center of great empires. Okay, I think today we are in a terrible crisis, and that's what we have to understand. We should not use the word fascism. We should be thinking about the crisis of the liberal international order, which tried to set itself up after the Cold War order, which is what defeated the fascists. The United States has failed now to lead that order, and new movements are coming up to exploit that. And we can't fight it by saying, you're fascist, you're fascist, you're fascist, you're fascist, you look like a fascist, you smell like a fascist. Fascists do this and this and this, they're anti-Semitic, tick off boxes, typologize. I think that's utterly mistaken. What we have to do is understand the failure of US leadership domestically and abroad, and how this failure has done so many things to undo the stability that the United States had brought to the international order, And that means winning electorally, clearly.
Yes.
Whoever, winning electorally, but with a program to address those major issues, which are the source of crisis. Climate change, inequality. What do you do with these outsider hegemons like China, Russia, which is always gets kicked out and kicked around? Okay, there's a lot of problems there. How do you get them in? How do you rebuild the international institutions? But first of all, how do you rebuild the American institutions, which are so run down? So run down. We've not invested in institutions, really. I mean, you'd say the last time was the 70s. That was the last big investment. So that's how I end up sitting, that Mussolini, brilliant politician, was able to exploit, bring in half-baked people, second-raters like Taruzzi, given the big careers, but they were exploiting this situation to seize power and to become a global model. So that we have to understand, not the moral denunciation, oh, they're immoral, they're this or this or that. That they are, of course. I mean, that goes, maybe it goes without saying, but what's the project that will push that back? Think high, think for the future. We'll leave it there.
Thank you so much. Thank you for answering that question. And you've been a fascinating guest. Once again, I want to let my listeners know that I love this book. It is just a wonderful read. It really is. I have been talking to Victoria Di Grazia. The book is called The Perfect Fascist, a story of love, power, and morality in Mussolini's Italy. Victoria, thank you so very much for joining us at Life Elsewhere.
Thank you so much, Norman. Thank you.
Oggi che magnifica giornata, che giornata di felicità. La mia bella donna se n'è andata, m'ha lasciato alpino in libertà. Son padrone ancora della mia vita, e goderla voglio sempre più. Ella m'ha giurato nel partir che non sarebbe ritornata mai più. Vivere senza malinconia, vivere senza più gelosia, senza rimpianti, senza mai più conoscere cos'è l'amore, cogliere il più bel fiore, goder la vita e far tacere il cuore, ridere sempre così giocondo, ridere delle follie del mondo, vivere affinché c'è gioventù, perché la vita è bella e la voglio vivere.
A very large thank you to my guests. Details about the books we feature at Life Elsewhere are always available at lifeelsewhere.co. Now, remember, you can hear this show again at our affiliate stations and as a podcast at NPR One, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts from. All the listings are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Now, make sure you let me know what you think of Life Elsewhere. My email address comes up in just a moment. Till next time, please be safe, be well, and always, you know it costs nothing. Be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.